and thank you for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, and Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. My guest today is Elizabeth Barnes. Elizabeth is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Virginia, and she's the author of a fabulous new book titled The Minority Body, A Theory of Disability. The book is published by Oxford University Press. Now, in this book, Elizabeth explores a broad range of philosophical questions concerning our conceptualization of disability. What is disability? What makes it such that a condition is a disability rather than, say a disease or merely a way of being different? Is disability always and intrinsically bad? Are disabilities things that are to be cured? What role should the testimony and experience of disabled persons play in our thinking about these questions? Now, Elizabeth argues that, at least for a range of conditions characterized as disabilities, disabilities are merely ways in which bodies can be different, not ways of being intrinsically badly off. Now, there's a lot to talk about, even given that little statement of the core of Elizabeth's view, and we'll get to that in a minute. But before going into those details, let's begin where we usually do, namely by greeting our guest. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. I'm really excited to be talking to you. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Well, and thank you for joining us today. So we usually begin, Elizabeth, with the author. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this this project?
Sure. Yeah. So as you said, I am a philosophy professor at the University of Virginia. And I guess how I got into this project was a little bit of a roundabout way of coming to a book on disability. My background, my graduate training, what I wrote my sort of first published papers on, is actually in analytic metaphysics. So I did metaphysics, epistemology, philosophy of language. That was what a lot of my training was in. So definitely a little bit further afield from this kind of thing, the kind of thing that I'm doing now. I was always really interested in the philosophy of disability, but it was something I was a little hesitant to work on, partly because I am myself a person with a disability. I'm a disabled person. And for some reason, I felt like that sort of meant that I shouldn't do the philosophy of disability because I wasn't going to be able to do it right, or I was going to be too personally invested in it or too emotional about it, or I don't know. It just, it was something that I felt like I was very interested in. And I was interested in disability studies more broadly, the sort of broader cross humanities conversation that's disability studies. But I wasn't sure that was the kind of thing that would be appropriate for me to do philosophy about. But I found myself continually being drawn towards it and it being something that I wanted to do. And especially I kept reading papers that I just felt, I was like, no, that's people are saying things that I feel like aren't resonant with partly with the broader conversation and disability studies, but also just with, you know, my experience as somebody who is a disabled person. This just doesn't seem to make sense. Felt like the conversation was missing something. And so eventually I couldn't keep my mouth shut. I started to work on disability, and a book came out of that pretty quickly. And then this book is published in OUP's series Studies in Feminist Philosophy. Mm-hmm. And my interest in feminist philosophy actually came directly out of my interest in disability and the philosophy of disability, because I found that there were a lot of there were a lot of really close issues and similar issues, and sort of thinking about the way we think about disabled bodies now, it was really helpful to think about the way, certainly historically, the female body was kind of pathologized and thought of as defective and that kind of thing. And there were a lot of resources and tools within feminist philosophy that were already there and were helpful to me. And certainly I found a lot of the information in feminist philosophy a little bit more helpful thinking about disability than I did maybe a lot of the resources in bioethics, which is probably how disability-centric conversations in philosophy are more familiarly conceptualized. So yeah, that's kind of where the project came from. It came from me sort of thinking about these things and eventually getting myself to a place where I was annoyed enough that I wanted to say something. I think also getting to a place where I felt like, yeah, this is something that's a personal topic for me, but also disability is personal for everybody.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people who are non-disabled are pretty emotionally attached to being non-disabled. It's a human thing, to be personally invested in this. So I felt like, I could get to a place where, yeah, I can still make arguments about this. So it was getting over that hurdle and that barrier that I think being personally invested is not any sort of barrier to doing a good philosophy, that allowed me to want to do this.
Right. I suspect that there's probably a lot of really good philosophy that secretly, maybe not in every case secretly, maybe overtly, has agitation as its as its origin. Well, great. So why don't we turn to the argument of the book then, having heard about how you got into it. So obviously, I think the first issue on the agenda is the sort of conceptual issue, which is perhaps in some ways closer to your original training in philosophy, the sort of metaphysics and epistemology, and maybe some of the philosophy of language issues about terminology. Mm-hmm. So the book begins with the conceptual questions. What are we talking about? Is there one thing called disability? Are there just many things that are individual disabilities with maybe nothing more than family resemblances connecting them? Are there clusters where there are more close conceptual connections? So can you tell us a little bit sort of about some of the, I mean, there's a range of sort of conceptual issues that get disentangled and analyzed early in the book. Can you run us through some of those arguments? And then I might just ask as a follow-up sort of, what's disability anyway?
So first of all, one of my starting point is that I wanted to focus exclusively on physical disability. So not assuming that there is any such thing as physical disability. I just don't want to assume that anything I'm going to say sort of subsequently in the book is going to hold true of what we might think of as other types of disability. So maybe psychosocial disability or cognitive disability. I also don't want to assume, I think we tend to assume that there is this tripartite distinction. So there's this there's this broad heading, disability, and then there are three types, so psychosocial, cognitive, and physical. I don't think there's much of an argument that anything like this classificatory system is, in fact, the case. And I think that one of the things, especially as someone who is physically disabled, that we need to be really careful of is not doing what has definitely been done a lot in the history of investigations into disability, which is treating physical disability as a paradigm case and then kind of assuming that what you would say goes for physical disability goes for other types of disability. Eva Kitte, the wonderful philosopher of disability, Eva Kitte, has the lovely phrase where she says that we need to understand disability as a big tent. Mm-hmm. And we need to understand that there's a lot of heterogeneity and a lot of different experiences. So I definitely just sort of didn't want to attempt to tackle the question of whether there is this thing, disability, that unifies the experiences of someone who's a wheelchair user with someone who deals with bipolar disorder, with someone who deals with autism versus someone who has Down syndrome, you know. That was a bigger question than I felt personally equipped to tackle. So I wanted to start with the case of physical disability and ask the question of whether there's any sense in which the things that we label physical disabilities can be said to have anything in common with each other, whether there's a kind here. We sort of talk about it as though there's a kind there, right? You know, the thing that these that the disabilities have, physical disabilities have in common with each other is that they're disabilities. But when you actually look at the range of physical conditions that we call physical disabilities, that's weird. It's weird that we think that these things all have something in common with each other. Because, you know, you look at achondroplasia and you compare it to multiple sclerosis and you compare that to congenital deafness and you compare that to spinal cord injury. It's really non-obvious.
Right.
What, if anything, all these very, very disparate physical conditions have in common with each other. So I think for anybody who's interested in these broader questions of disability, like, you know, what's the connection between disability and well-being, or is disability something that makes you worse off, or the, you know, the kind of questions that I wanted to tackle, the biggest question that you have to start with is this sort of specter of error theory, which is just, is there any, you know, why shouldn't we just say that there is nothing that is disability?
There's no there.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's the sort of lurking question in the background. So I'm halfway sympathetic to the idea that there's nothing that these various physical conditions have in common, because I think there's not a natural kind that is disability. I don't think there's any, we can point to any sort of natural feature or natural property or anything like this that unifies all the very disparate physical conditions that we call disabilities. So one of the things I try to do at the beginning of the book is just look at some attempts to explain in naturalistic terms what unifies all the physical conditions that we think of as disabilities like what it is that makes a physical condition a disability, and kind of explain why I think those accounts are probably going to be doomed to failure. They're either going to overgeneralize or undergeneralize, sometimes kind of both at the same time.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think probably the most common way of trying to explain what physical disabilities have in common with each other is via some idea of normal function.
Right.
So the disabilities are the departures from normal function. You have to immediately complicate that a little bit, because there are a lot of ways of being departures from normal function that pretty clearly aren't disabilities, because, you know, your average elite athlete is a departure from normal function,
right?
In various interesting ways. So you have this idea of negative departure from normal function, where negative isn't meant to be something normative. It's meant to be the kind of departure from normal function that is going to impede long-term survival and reproduction. And that's meant, so the idea is that disabilities and maybe also diseases, I think a lot of naturalistic accounts don't necessarily see a difference between disability and disease. So disabilities are going to be the thing that are departures from normal function that are going to impede long-term survival and reproduction. And I talk about various cases in the book, but I think this kind of account, this more sophisticated account, is still not going to work as a theory of what disability is, because there are some disabilities that it seems like the reason they've been passed on, the reason they exist, is because they're adaptive in some circumstances. So they certainly don't seem to have impeded reproduction. it's also the case that it looks like there's plenty of things that might be departures from normal function that impede long-term survival and reproduction, but which we don't think of as disabilities.
Right.
And so it looks like the normal function account is going to cast its net too broad. Right. It might include a lot of the things that we think of as disabilities, but it's also going to include a lot of other things that we don't think of as disabilities. So it's not really getting at what is characteristic of disability. I think moving on from there, people have people who want to say that there is a thing that is disability have moved to the idea that, okay, so if there's a kind and it's not a naturalistic kind, we need to say that disability is socially constructed. And social construction, of course, is this term that gets thrown around a lot, and people mean very, very different things by it. I think the most common way, certainly within disability studies more broadly, for people to say that disability is socially constructed is for people to make a distinction between disability and impairment.
Right.
So the idea is that basically this is an attempt to do the same thing for disability that in feminist philosophy people, or just feminist theory more broadly, people have done for sex and gender. Right. So there's biological differences between bodies that have to do with reproduction. That roughly is sex. And then there's the social meaning of sex, and that's gender. So people have attempted to do the same thing for disability. So there's various physical conditions. Those are impairments. And then there's the social disadvantage imposed on some bodies because of contingent ways in that our society is set up that privileges some bodies and disadvantages others. And that's disability. So this is the kind of model of disability that's offered by like the social model of disability, for example. So on views like this, disability is the disadvantage that is the social disadvantage that arises from the way we treat certain people. So the sort of slogan or catchphrase that gets tossed around a lot is that disability is not a property of bodies.
Right.
There's been a bunch of pushback against views like this for various different reasons. It's really hard to characterize what the difference is between disability and impairment, what exactly the impairments are supposed to be. There's also a big worry that this type of view makes disability overly disembodied.
Right.
Disability just is the sort of disadvantage that you accrue from the way people treat you. And the idea is that impairments in an ideal situation would just be sort of nuisances, maybe, but they wouldn't have this dramatic effect. The dramatic effect that they have is entirely due to social prejudice. And you might think that's plausible for some disabilities, but not for all of them. So there's been various worries about this. So the sort of model that I tried to argue for was a more moderate version of social constructionism, basically, where disability is a property of bodies. It's just a socially constructed property of bodies. So, you know, there are objective features of bodies that make it the case that you are disabled. But the reason that we think that a certain set of objective physical features are the set that is the disabilities, the set that we sort of saliently mark out and say, ah, these are the disabilities. These things have something in common with each other, is because of social facts rather than natural facts. It's because, you know, because of some arbitrary decisions about how we decided to group people together. We think, ah, all of these physical features go together. In a way that's interesting. There's no sort of naturalistic fact that explains why all these features go together. So, you know, whether you're disabled it is in some sense an objective fact about what your body is like, but the reason that that fact about what your body is like is particularly socially salient is because of how we think about people rather than sort of objective facts about how some bodies are more similar to other bodies or something like that.
Can I ask just a quick question, just to clarify in my own mind, sort of the distinction between the view that you're laying out, the your own view, and the more straightforward social constructivist views.
Yes.
The social constructivist about disability seems to be committed to the thought that if social institutions and norms and practices and whatever else we want to put into that category were changed, or maybe were made just, or were rendered consistent with equality, then there'd be no disability. Is that right?
Yes. But
your view doesn't hold that. Is that true, that there would be disability even if we got all the institutional stuff right?
Yeah, my view is kind of silent on that. It's perfectly consistent with my view that there could still be social significance to disability, completely in the absence of disadvantage.
Gotcha.
Right? Because it could just be the case, you know, you might think even in a world where we had a lot more accommodation, where we had a lot more accessibility, it's still the case that people with certain kinds of physical conditions are going to do things differently, right? Their bodies are unusual in some interesting way, right? They're probably going to navigate the world a little bit differently. And that could still be socially significant, even if it doesn't accrue tons of disadvantage.
Gotcha. Right. Yeah. Right. Great. Please continue. Tell us more.
So I think sometimes people have this idea about social constructionist views of disability that you're saying, somehow that there is no objective reality to disability or something like that. Somehow to say that something is socially constructed is to say that it isn't real. And I think you can say that something is socially constructed and that it's real. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, it's a real, if someone is blind, it is a real and objective fact about them that they cannot see. And if someone is has a spinal cord injury, it is a real and objective fact about their body that they, you know, have this particular injury that they have. I think what's important about a social constructionist analysis is, one, pushing the idea that there's a lot more to being disabled than just having a particular physical feature. But also that the reason why we think that blindness has something special in common with spinal cord injury, has something special in common with multiple sclerosis, has something special in common with achondroplasia, is very much to do with how we think of certain types of bodies as normal and then certain types of bodies as, you know, defective or departures from normal, rather than objective similarities that very wide range of bodies has between each other. And of course, that's not to say that there's no objective reality to the fact that, you know, if you're blind, you can't see. And if you have a spinal cord injury, there are things that, you know, you won't be able to do with your legs and things like that. That's all totally real. You don't have to deny the objective reality of the physical conditions that we associate with disability to then say, at the same time, it's more of a social fact about us that we assign these physical conditions the particular type of social meaning that we do. So that's kind of the view that I was arguing for, a sort of middle ground. Yeah, whether you're disabled is a fact about your body, but the fact that we group things together as disabilities is more of a fact about us than it's a natural kind or something like that.
Great. Given that kind of analysis of, you know, what disabilities are. You've got a new issue emerges, which is sort of what's the significance of disability? And here you're keen to advance a conception of disability as a mere difference rather than as a bad difference. Can you tell us a little bit about that, particularly about the arguments of why you're keen to deny that being that a body's being disabled, you want to deny that a body's being disabled is a way of its being badly off?
Right. Yeah. So I think probably the central question of the book is the connection between the things we think of as disabilities, so the connection between having one of these physical conditions and well-being, right? Because it certainly, exactly as you're right, exactly as you say, it doesn't fall out from a categories being socially constructed that it's, it doesn't have some sort of substantive negative effect on your well-being.
Right.
There are plenty of categories that are broadly socially constructed that, you know, have a terrible effect on your well-being, and it would be better if we could make the world a place such that, people would no longer fall into these categories, like refugee or domestic violence victim or things like this.
Well, think of all the race theory that is social constructivist precisely because they're interested in counteracting the negative effects, right?
Well, I mean, or like Haslinger's view of gender is basically the goal of feminism is to get rid of women.
That's right. It's a strange way to put it, but yeah.
The upshot is that it would be better if there weren't if people didn't fall into these categories. Yeah.
Right.
I think certainly it's common sense, right? For whatever that's worth, that having a disability is something that is the kind of thing that makes you worse off. At least there's a tight correlation between having a disability and having your life be less good than it could be.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I think we're very familiar with the idea that you can have a disability and lead a good life. But we tend to understand that in terms of, disabled people, they overcome the badness of their disability,
right?
Or disabled people, they persevere through the badness of their disability, and that teaches them, I don't know, like wonderful things about patience or fortitude or something like that. And those are certainly the familiar narratives about disability that we have, or despite,
right? They live well despite.
Despite of, rather than just living well.
Right.
And I think that it's been a very common thing. If you are disabled and you seem fine, people seem to go out of their way to tell you that you're inspirational, in ways that you're just living a disabled life and, you know, it's just quite a normal life. It's very confusing to be told that you're inspirational. So sort of first step of the argument that I try to make is that it's actually really, really difficult once you sit down and think about it. To put flesh on the bones of that common sense idea. So what do people really mean? Or what are we really saying when we think that there is a negative connection between disability and well-being, or that disability is the kind of thing that makes you worse off? Because if you have a very specific theory of well-being that's sort of broadly a very strong objectivist Aristotelian theory of well-being or something like that, then it's not too hard. You can say, there are a bunch of intrinsic goods that you need to have in order to have like a fully flourishing life. And if you are disabled, maybe you're missing out on one of those goods or several of those goods. So you're been moved down a couple of rungs on the great ladder of well-being. So that's the sense in which you're worse off. But that's a very strong view of well-being, and certainly that's not the sense of well-being in which a lot of people who are parties of this conversation are talking about well-being. So it gets a lot more complicated if maybe you've got a hybrid theory of well-being, or a desire satisfaction theory of well-being, or a preference-based theory of well-being or something like that, to say exactly what the common sense view is supposed to be, or indeed what motivates the common sense view of well-being. Because certainly there is a lot of empirical evidence that suggests that disabled people don't rate their life satisfaction as particularly different than non-disabled people, though there's a lot of evidence that suggests that non-disabled people predict that disabled people will say that they're worse off and this kind of thing. Now, of course, you might just be broadly skeptical about the project of hedonic psychology, where people go around and just interview people and say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you? So there's questions there. There's also a lot of empirical evidence that suggests that well-being in disabled people doesn't track what we expect it to track. So we expect it to track the sort of what you might think of as what often gets called objective severity in disability, and instead it tends to track things like social support and the person's attitude towards their disability. For example, whether they have a sense of acceptance of their disability and things like that. So in that sense, it's not clear what the evidence for the common sense view is supposed to be. It's also not clear why we think it's so common sense that it is being disabled that's bad for you,
right,
rather than being disabled in a social context in which it's actually pretty difficult to be disabled. Because certainly, if you look at the studies that they did on well-being and anxiety and depression rates for gay people in the 1980s, it would be weird to conclude from that being gay is something that by itself just makes you worse off.
Right.
It was pretty obviously the case that there were other factors going on. It wasn't being gay that made you worse off. It was being gay in a really homophobic society at the start of the AIDS epidemic. So when you consider just how hard it is for so many disabled people to find work because of the difficulty of accommodation, the crisis for a lot of disabled people getting adequate health care, the social stigma about disability, how common it is if a person acquires disability for their spouse to leave them, these kind of things. So when you look at all the social factors that go into people's experience of disability, no wonder it might be pretty difficult for people to experience disability in that social situation. It looks like the claim that we need to make is something like this is a counterfactual one. The claim that we need to make is a counterfactual one that says disability would still have this robust correlation to negative effects on well-being, even in a world that was much more accommodating of disabled people, even in a world that had much less stigma about disability. And that looks like an interesting, a much less obvious claim. It's
right.
Interesting, I think, that people think that that is so common sense. Because counterfactual judgments about worlds that are pretty different than ours, I don't know, I'm not particularly confident in judgments like that.
Yeah, right.
So I think it's interesting that we think that it's that common sense.
Right. And it's even it's a judgment about a counterfactual about what's common sense to think. It's not even a judgment, right? It's not even a judgment about what's correct. It's like, what's common sense to think in these highly counterfactual, which I have even less confidence in.
Yeah. What's meant to be obvious.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think that, and this is part of the argument for what I call the mirror difference view, which is that basically disability is something that certainly absolutely makes you different, but doesn't by itself make you worse off. So basically, I deny that it's characteristic of disability that there's any sort of negative, or for that matter, positive connection between disability and well-being. Disability doesn't by itself or intrinsically have any sort of robust connection to well-being. That's what I take to be the characteristic feature of what I call mere difference views of disability. Disability absolutely makes you unusual, but it doesn't by itself or automatically make you worse off. So I think one of the reasons why people find that idea so, counterintuitive, or maybe they think it's just sort of obviously wrong, is that they have this understanding of disability, where disability is just sort of like, is just a lack or just a privation. Mm-hmm. So they think, you know, here's all the things a normal person can do. Take a little bit away. That's the experience of disability. So obviously that's got to be less good, right? Obviously that's got to be less. So it's got to be obvious that disability is bad. When in fact, if you actually look at the testimony of disabled people and how they talk about their experiences, disability is a lot more than just take a normal person and take a few things away. Disability is a much more, is a much richer, much more varied experience than that. And I think people focus on what disabled people don't have, and what they can't do. And they forget to listen to disabled people about the ways in which their lives are enriched, the ways in which, you know, because they do things differently, because they often navigate the world very differently than non-disabled people do, they have often unique and very different experiences that they can find valuable. So I think a lot of times the way in which we think it's obvious that disability is just something that's bad for you has to do with not fully understanding what it is to be disabled, what disabled people say about their own experience. So the way that I try to argue for the mere difference view is by, first of all, saying just how strong a commitment what I call the bad difference view is, and then looking at the testimony that we get from disabled people, the ways that disabled people describe their experiences, these kind of things, and trying to give an argument that the strength of the claims that you would have to make for bad difference views aren't justified given what we actually know about disabled people and what they say about their experiences, what they say about their own well-being, that kind of thing.
Excellent. So I want to get to the discussion about testimony in the book, but before that, could you spell out your view is a particular kind of mere difference view, what you call a value neutral version of the mere difference view. Before we get to the testimony stuff, could you spell out a little bit what the value neutral version of the mere difference view looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. So a big part of what I was trying to do in the book was to steer what I thought of as a middle ground between sort of what might be thought of as two extremes of parties to a conversation. So on the one hand, you have what I take as the both maybe what's the common sense position, but also just the typical position in analytic philosophy, which is just, it's super obvious that disability is bad for you in a way that is independent of how disabled people are treated, in a way such that we could say there's this tight counterfactual connection between disability and being worse off. having less well-being or having a lower level of well-being than non-disabled people. On the other hand, there are views like the social model of disability, which I think maybe in some cases they strike people as too strong. They strike me as too strong. And I think sometimes people have been pushed to say things that are stronger than they need to be. Because there's this thought that, okay, if you want to deny that disability is bad, if you want to deny that there's this tight connection between disability and reduction in well-being, then you have to make this move that says all the bad effects of disability are just a result of how disabled people are treated.
Right.
So if we treated disabled people better, those bad effects would go away. And personally, I don't find that plausible. But I also don't think that you need to say that to hold a mere difference view. So I think that there are a lot of things about at least some disabilities that, you know, would be difficult, would be hard, would be complicated, even in the absence of social prejudice against disabled people. So some disabilities are painful. Some disabilities require ongoing medical care. Some disabilities are degenerative, so on and so on and so on. And these are just, you know, that's the truth. That's the you know, what disability is like for a lot of people. And I think it's important to be honest about that and to say, yeah, look, there are some things about being disabled that for a lot of people are difficult and are hard. And probably still would be hard, although, you know, no doubt easier, even in the absence of social prejudice. But there are also some things about often those very same disabilities that are good and that are valuable and that enrich your life. So I guess the view that I wanted to defend tries to have a more nuanced picture of disability where, you know, in a way, disability is a many splendored thing. disability is complicated. When it comes to well-being, disability is a mixed bag. But I think that makes disability actually pretty similar to a lot of other features that are socially significant, like sex, like sexual orientation. In a way that, yeah, you know, oftentimes they are both in terms of how people treat you based on them, but also just in terms of your experience of them independent of how people treat you. They can be a real mixed bag. They can have some things that are good and some things that are bad and some things that you value and some things that you wish were different. And that's consistent with saying on the whole that by themselves, they don't make you better. They don't make you worse. They're just different. Or they're just, you know, they're just neutral.
I see.
So the idea for this view that I call the value neutral view of disability is that disability by itself is not the kind of thing in virtue of which your life goes better or in virtue of which your life goes worse. But that is consistent with disability sometimes or even always being something that we can say in a restricted sense is a harm.
Right.
So a harm with respect to some features or with respect to sometimes. And that's also consistent with disability being something that on the whole is bad for some people, depending on what it's combined with. depending on, you know, what people want, what their projects are, what kind of lives they're trying to lead. It's also consistent with it being something that, you know, makes some people's lives go better.
Sure.
I think we don't want to, you know, forget that side of the equation either. You know, I think sometimes you see these arguments that kind of move like this. They say, you know, listening to classical music, I don't know why it's always classical music.
Because there are a lot of snobs in philosophy.
Right. It can never be punk rock. Listening to classical music is good. We need to be able to say that's just valuable. That's something that's valuable. If you're deaf, you can't listen to, you can't appreciate, or at least you can't auditorily appreciate classical music. So that's a good thing that you miss out on. Therefore, it is worse to be deaf than to be hearing. And then they say, so if you think that it's not worse to be deaf than to be hearing, you have to deny that there's value to listening to classical music. I've seen this argument in print multiple times.
Yeah, and it's obviously crazy. It's obviously bad. Let's put it that way.
So I think the person who wants to defend the idea that it's not worse to be disabled can say, look, sure, yes, it is great to listen to classical music. Okay, you know, if you want to, classical music or indeed punk rock. And that's great. And that's something, yes, that if you are deaf, you cannot auditorily appreciate classical music. And so if you have this like strong objectivist theory of value, yes, that's something of value that you miss out on. There are lots of things about deaf people's experiences that are also valuable.
Right.
That your average hearing person misses out on. Right. So there is the linguistic experience of people whose first language is a signed language rather than a spoken language. There's the experience. I have a friend who is an ASL speaker, and she frequently talks about how unexpressive spoken language is, and how frustrating she finds it to have to like translate things into spoken language because she can't put the same emphasis on things that she would like to. So she just really prefers ASL compared to spoken language. There's also, I read this great article by a woman who's deaf, who talked about the incredible sensory experience. And she actually has hearing aids, but she says as she gets older, she's just wearing them less and less. But the incredible experience of going someplace like New York City and just not having her hearing aids, having them out or totally turned off, and just walking through crowds and bustle and everything and having nothing but silence. And just the incredible sensory experience that is. The experience of experiencing music through vibration rather than through sound. In London once a year, there's a local organization of deaf people that puts on a deaf dance party. Mm-hmm. And they have this big room that has a sprung floor, and they get these giant speakers and they take them and they flip them over. So they put them all face down on the floor and then turn them up as high as they go. And then deaf people, and for the ones that have hearing aids, they'll all take out their hearing aids and then they just go. And it looks like they're dancing to nothing if you've ever seen it.
Right.
But it's amazing. And they talk about the experience of that, you know, I have no phenomenological concept of as a hearing person, but they talk about what it's like to, basically to dance to vibration. You know, these kind of things that are just different experiences of the world also seem valuable, you know?
Right.
So you can grant, yes, of course. Fine. Listening to classical music, that's great. And yes, there's a sense in which, as people who don't listen to unable to listen to classical music, there's a sense in which deaf people miss out on something. But there's also a lot of things that deaf people have that are unique and special that hearing people don't have. And So I think the idea behind the view that I wanted to defend is to say, you can say that disabilities are sometimes or always with respect to a specific feature or to a specific time or something like that, something that is, in a local sense, a harm for you. But the very same thing that's in a local sense a harm for you or in a local sense bad for you can also be in other areas, in other senses, good for you, such that on the whole, it's not bad or good for you. It's just different.
Right.
That's also consistent with disability, even in the absence of social prejudice, being bad for some people. So I don't think that being deaf is bad for a lot of the deaf people that I know. I think it was bad for Beethoven.
Yeah.
You know? If your whole world revolves around the auditory experience of music, I think it's overly... it seems kind of imperialistic to say, no, we have to have a view of disability that says deafness wasn't bad for Beethoven. Sure. I mean, deafness is bad. Was bad for Beethoven. I think it should be consistent with a mere difference of disability that says disability can be bad for individual people, depending on what they want, depending on their projects, depending on all sorts of things about them. And that's consistent with disability itself being something that is neutral.
Right, and that also enables you to resist what I think is also, you might call it the X, I think in the book you call it the X-Men theory, which is wherever there's a disability, there is this heightened other power that comes into being.
Yeah, the only way to say that disability isn't bad would be to somehow say that disabled people get extra special senses or extra special abilities or something like that, which of course is absurd. I think sometimes it's easy to read the idea that so the same thing that is bad for you in some places could also be good for you in other places. The only way it could be good for you in other places, if you lose an ability here, then you have to gain some other ability, right, somewhere else. Whereas I think what a lot of disabled people actually say are things that, unless we have a very, very, very loose understanding of abilities, it's nothing to do with gaining heightened senses or, you hear people talk about things blind people have better hearing or things like that, which is true. certainly doesn't seem like a model that's generalizable for disabilities, but, So Harriet McBride Johnson had this is wonderful descriptions in her autobiography, where she talked about just her sensory experience as a wheelchair user, of just navigating the world from a different height than most people do, and from a different vantage point than most people do, and how much she valued her experience of just doing things differently than people, than other people do. And how much she enjoyed what she got to see and how she got to see people who typically didn't see her and didn't look at her. She could get this, kind of had a different eye level, different view of the world, which she found really experientially valuable. That was something she really enjoyed. Simi Linton, who is a disability rights activist and a disability studies scholar, talks about her experience of becoming disabled, as I think she was in her early 20s when she became disabled, and how much that was liberating for her as a woman, because she had had, she had faced all these pressures as a young woman of here's what your body has to be like, here's what you have to look like, here's, so all these pressures that young women face, that she had found so stressful, and so she had this impossible standard to live up to. All these standards of how you ought to be. But of course there's this sense in which ought implies can. And then suddenly she had this body that was irrevocably different. And she said it was just the most liberating thing that had ever happened to her.
Right.
Because she had permission to be abnormal. She had permission to just say, do you know what? Actually, I'm not going to dress like that. I'm not going to do my hair like that. I'm not going to wear makeup. I'm not, you know, just like suddenly she could be different because she had to be different.
Right.
So it's these kind of things that people often reference when they're talking about their experiences of disability. It's very much not, you know, you get these special heightened senses or something like that.
Well, so why don't we pick up there? Because one of the sort of dimensions of the argument, both with respect to what we were just sort of indirectly talking about, which is taking the testimony of disabled people seriously in our theorizing about the philosophical questions that come up, but also taking seriously the fact that disability communities are often organized around a sense of pride and even celebration. Mm-hmm. Can you sort of tie those two pieces together? They seem to me conceptually similar. That you're committed to this thought that whatever the philosophical story we tell or the ethical story we tell about disabilities, it would be wrong both to lose sight of the pride and celebratory character of some of the activities that go on with disabled community with persons in disabled communities, but also that we can't lose sight of the philosophical significance of the testimony of disabled mm-hmm. people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's the slogan of the disability rights movement, especially in America, is nothing about us without us.
Right.
And there's a very specific reason why that became sort of the rallying cry. And it was because almost always laws that had been passed, allegedly for the promotion of disabled people or for the protection of disabled people, were passed by non-disabled people without consulting disabled people and without reference to disabled people. So there was this idea that was typically implicit. You know, it wasn't, no one was around there twirling their mustaches and, you know, cackling that they were going to screw over disabled people. But there was this idea that non-disabled people have the ability without talking to disabled people, without asking disabled people, without any, you know, to know what's in disabled people's best interests, and to know what disabled people need, to know what disabled people want, to really have the ability to speak on their behalf. And if you look back at the history of protections for disabled people, laws for disabled people, social programs for disabled people, that typically ends in disaster. It doesn't go very well. So the idea of nothing about us without us is basically just the very simple idea that if you want to know about the lives of disabled people, if you want to know what disabled people need, if you want to know what they want, you need to ask them. And it's a very striking feature about the history of disabled people and the history of progress in disability rights, that very simple idea is something that disabled people have had to and continue to have to fight for. Because there is this pernicious but very common idea that not only often do we think that non-disabled people are a pretty good source of knowing what's good for disabled people, but also oftentimes that disabled people themselves are a pretty bad source of knowing what's good for disabled people for all sorts of complicated reasons. So this is, I think, a very, very ubiquitous struggle for disabled people, is just getting people to listen to them. Getting people to pay attention to them, getting the opportunity to be heard. So I think that certainly a very common reaction to disability positive testimony, by which I mean disabled people who say that they value their disability, that their disability is something that is, you know, important part of who they are, and they wouldn't want to be otherwise. They wouldn't want to be other than how they are, right? A very common response to this testimony is skepticism. People just, they either reinterpret what is said along the lines of that sort of tragic overcomer narrative that we talked about before. Right. Like, what people must be saying is, you know, I'm really glad that I am the person I am because I've overcome so much hardness. I'm really glad that I'm the person I've become because I've learned these lessons about perseverance or something like that. Even when that is explicitly not what the person is saying. Right. Or people think, okay, you know, interesting that you would say that, but, you know, natural for you to form an attachment to this fact about yourself. We shouldn't infer anything about that. We shouldn't infer from that anything about, in general, disability being a valuable part of human diversity or something like that. Because, and then insert some sort of skeptical hypothesis. So because we should just interpret this as a certain type of problematic adaptive preference, or we should just interpret this as status quo bias, or we should just interpret this as et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Even like Stockholm syndrome kind of thoughts, right?
So people say this kind of thing. So they say, you know, like, maybe that's a politically expedient thing for you to say. Maybe that, that's going to give you some cold comfort in, you know, your long nights of loneliness when you're there stuck with your disability. So, you know, it would make sense that you would want to talk yourself into it. But we shouldn't really believe that that's true. So it's maybe a certain type of noble lie. And it's maybe a good thing for people to believe. But we shouldn't think it's true. So I think this is a very, very common form of skepticism about disability positive testimony. It's kind of like, oh, you know, good for you for believing that. It makes sense for you to believe that, but we shouldn't think it's true. So I think one of the lines that I try to push in the book is that type of skepticism, actually, if you look back at the history of groups of people who have tried to speak back against the way in which, you know, their particular group has been devalued or undervalued or stigmatized. That type of skepticism has a not particularly attractive philosophical history.
Yeah.
It should be deployed with caution, I guess, is what I think about it. That's not to say there aren't cases where you're not justified in not believing what somebody says about their own well-being. I think Stockholm syndrome is a great example of a case where, you know, I don't actually believe that being kidnapped is good for people just because they say it is.
Right.
So I think, you know, we should never be in a position where we just treat people's first person testimony as sacrosanct, unquestionable, or something like that. That's not how testimony works. And it's also the case that, you know, I think testimony should be criticizable. It should be the kind of thing that we interrogate, that we should, you know, think through carefully. But there is this worry that certain types of people are often thought of as less reliable or more prone to these kind of skeptical hypotheses, precisely because of stereotypes that we have about what kind of people are reliable or what kind of lives are good lives or that kind of thing. I invoke the idea that Miranda Fricker has this idea of testimonial injustice. So the idea that because of a certain person's social position, because of the social position that they occupy, because of stereotypes we have about the kind of person that they are, or the kind of life they must lead, or something like that, we treat them as less reliable sources of testimony. And I think that in a lot of cases, that's what we're doing with disabled people. So I try to push the argument that in many cases, we're not actually justified in being as skeptical as we tend to be about this first-person testimony, on pain of if we applied these kind of standards across the board, we would just be generally skeptical of what people say about well-being, and we're not. So we do tend to be especially skeptical, I think, of disabled people, often in a way that I think fits fairly well this pattern that Fricker has fairly, I think, lucidly identified as what she calls testimonial injustice.
Well, wonderful. So we can keep talking because there's still things in the book that are really, really fascinating. Sometimes when I've done these on some books at the end, the interviewee says, "Bob, I said everything that was in the book. Now nobody has to go out and read it." This is not the case with your book. There are all kinds of things that we just haven't had time to get to. But so, Elizabeth, I want to thank you for your time. And so I usually end with a final question, which is, what's your next project?
So right now, I'm thinking a lot about gender. Yeah, I've just gotten really, I guess, fascinated by the idea of by general questions in social metaphysics and you know, what unifies social groups and how we think about social position and social stigma and that kind of thing. So I've started to think quite a lot about gender. And I'm particularly interested in the differences between different types of social categories. You know, so why might it be that I think disability is a particularly embodied social category? So it really matters to whether you're disabled what your body is like. And I think it matters less how you self-identify. So you cannot self-identify as disabled and still be disabled. And you can self-identify as disabled and not be disabled. And I think that's not true of gender. I think gender is maybe less embodied and more about identity. Certainly, I don't think gender just is gender identity. I don't think that identity is what explains gender. But I do think that gender is maybe not as embodied as disability. And I find that difference deeply puzzling, and something that I really want to think more about in general. So,
well, that sounds great. Thank you so much for your time today, and thank you, listeners, for joining us and tuning into the podcast and engaging with us in our discussion. Again, the book is titled The Minority Body, A Theory of Disability. It's published by Oxford University Press, and the author is Elizabeth Barnes. Thanks, everybody. Bye for now.